I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss the process of grief and how different people deal with the journey. A little later in the hour, Ann Gagan, Hope Community Care's bereavement director, will join us. But first,
Ann Hood is the author of the best-selling novels The Red Thread, The Knitting Circle, and Somewhere Off the Coast of Maine. Her memoir, Comfort, A Journey Through Grief, shares her personal story of losing her five-year-old daughter, Grace, in 2002. Ann Hood has two new books out now, a novel, The Obituary Writer, and a book she edited titled Knitting Yarns, a collection of essays about the transformative power of knitting. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Mindy. Good to see you.
Okay, so The Knitting Yarns is a collection of 27 essays, and in addition to editing the book, you are also a contributor.
Yes.
Your essay describes how knitting gave you some temporary relief from the grief of losing Grace. So tell us about the time and the solace you find in knitting.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to pull this anthology together was because of how much knitting helped me, continues to help me. And I just witness in airports and at readings, everywhere I go, how much it helps other people. You know, you see a knitter and they're in that zen place. Mm-hmm. And I thought the world needs to know this. And since I can't teach the world to knit, I just keep finding ways to write about it and have other people write mm-hmm. about it. For me, at a time when, you know, I really hit rock bottom after Grace died, and language actually, which had always been my solace, disappeared. And I couldn't even read the People magazine report on Michael Jackson's weird wedding. Mm. I mean, I could not read anything banal. Words just had no meaning. And wonderful, wise friends recommended that I learn to knit. And I have to say that even though that first afternoon in that knitting store, when I dropped every stitch and split more yarn than's mm-hmm. ever been split since, even then, I realized the comfort it brought, the way it silenced my mm-hmm. mind. Mm-hmm. I remember getting back into the car after two kind of hellish knitting hours and looking at the clock on the dashboard and being shocked that 2 hours had passed. Right. And for me, in 6 months, it was the first time that 2 hours had passed without either a panic attack or crying, or just this feeling of having to get out of my skin. Mm. I actually got back in that car calmer than I had felt in a very long time.
Right. Tell us about Grace.
Well, Grace was five when she died suddenly in April of 2002 of a virulent form of strep. And, you know, we did not even know she had strep throat. She was a funny, really smart kid with a very deep voice and glasses, and a character that we still get notes about from people who taught her or knew her. She was a gifted artist. I mean, I know with someone so young, everybody has sort of these stereotypical things they say about their children. They love them, mm-hmm. and we see how special they are. But she truly was a special, extraordinary kid.
So 11 years after losing Grace, do you ever find yourself turning to knitting now again during these difficult times? Because grief never really goes away. It changes.
As
you write in your books.
Yeah, and as we all know, right? Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, it's something we all learn. I knit all the time. I always carry my knitting in a Ziploc bag. I write about that in the essay in Knitting Yarns that I contributed. But it's interesting, I notice that when I'm knitting a lot, something's going on with mm-hmm. me. So I turn to its healing powers almost intuitively now. You know, it's kind of interesting. But I, of course, sometimes I just say, well, I want to make that cute hat. And I knit away. But often when I embark on big projects, I realize why.
Yeah. Sort of telling yourself what's going on inside. You know, your inner self is coming out.
Yeah. Before I know it, my knitting gene knows.
Yeah, exactly. So in Knitting Yarns, over 24 writers tell stories about how knitting healed, challenged, or helped them grow. For readers, many of these writers' names are familiar.
Oh, I have the most stellar lineup. I am so excited. You know, here was this seemingly crazy idea, kind of a lark, where I thought, well, you know, Anita Shreve knits. I knit with her, you know, and Eleanor Lippman knits, and on and on. And I thought, I wonder, and Elizabeth Berg. I mean, the list of people who I just had knit with. Anne LeClaire, my dear friend. So I just asked them, would you write an essay? And everyone jumped on it. Mm-hmm. And so I went to my editor, and I could see, I have to admit, that her eyes glazed over a little, like, enough with the knitting. And I said, I know it's kind of a hard sell for you, but, you know, to do more knitting, but here's who I have. And I had at that point about 12, Andre Debuse III, And she looked at the list and she said, I think we can make this work.
Right.
And so I asked each of them to pass on the names of writers they knew who knit. And before long, I had Jane Smiley, Ann Patchett, Barbara Kingsolver emailing me saying, could we be in the book?
Yeah. So where did this whole idea come from? Why did you think, let me try to find this and put this together?
Well, you know, it's interesting because as an addictive, obsessive knitter, which kind of is redundant because every knitter, those adjectives do fit. But I like to knit at readings. I actually believe I listen better when I'm knitting because knitting is this interesting thing where one of the reasons it calms you is your brain is both working and not working. Mm. It's this duality that doesn't exist in many other things. So I noticed as the back row knitter, because I didn't want to insult or disturb the reader, I would look around and I'd say, oh, well, there's, you know, Samantha Lan Chang knitting at this reading too. Mm. And then at some point after or before during the break, you know, you start exchanging stories. When did you learn? Is there a good knitting store in this town? And so I just began to have this second circle of writers who knit.
Hmm.
And their stories always were interesting. You know, I was with Hope Edelman, and she was talking about how her daughters loved to knit, but she didn't. But her mother had, and as you know, she wrote that very famous, wonderful book, Motherless Daughters. And I thought, you know, there's a lot of people who would benefit from what she's saying about generations of knitting. And so I just felt like it was time that the world heard all these stories.
Right. It's really interesting because I'm just trying to think here, you know, what is it about knitting that, you know, is so transformative? Because, you know, I will admit, I can only knit like a scarf, something straight. But there is something relaxing about that. It does.
Yeah,
like you say, that sort of zen state that it puts you in.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's ever been any research into what, what it is.
You're asking the right girl.
Oh, good.
There has been. Because I'm obsessive in general, when I realized how comforting it was for me, I started to research, is it just me? Is there really something? And I wrote an article quite a while ago now for a magazine called Body and Soul about the restorative powers of knitting. And really, there have been studies that there is actually a physiological thing that occurs that slows your heart rate and lowers your blood pressure and pulse. And in fact, one of the essays by Elisa Chappelle is about how she learned to knit because her blood pressure was high and the doctor said, knit.
Well, there's an alternative to blood pressure
medicine,
right?
How about that? You don't need statins. You need to knit.
Wow.
So there really is a physiological thing. But I think the research also shows that it is repetitive action is very soothing. Mm. And so although many people say, oh, knitting must be like yoga, it's actually quite different from yoga, which is hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, not a repetitive action.
Right.
But it's more like jogging or swimming.
Right. All right. I want to talk about the obituary writer.
Yes.
This novel features two main characters during two different time periods. There's Claire, a young wife and mother in the 1960s, who struggles over the decision of whether to stay in a loveless marriage or follow the man she loves and whose baby she may be carrying. Then we have Vivian Lowe, an obituary writer in 1919, searching for her lover, who disappeared in the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906. By telling the stories of the dead, Vivian not only helps others cope with their grief, but she begins to understand the devastation of her own terrible loss. And there's a surprising connection between these two women, part literary mystery, part love story. Excuse me. The obituary writer examines expectations of marriage and love, the roles of wives and mothers, and the emotions of grief, regret, and hope. So tell us about these two women. I love the two different time periods. And, you know, what's interesting, though, is Vivian seems to have a little more feminism in her than Claire.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because Vivian's story came first to me. And as you know from reading my work, anyone who's read it, I like multiple points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And so I struggled with how else can I illuminate her story? And I thought about using her best friend, even her missing lover, maybe someone random in the town. Nothing felt right. And watching Obama's inauguration gave me the idea of having someone in the Kennedy era. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a sort of a funny leap, you know. And Claire's story takes place just in 24 hours, the 24 hours of Kennedy's inauguration. And so when I began writing about these two seemingly disparate women. The eras are different. One thing that I learned is that really in 1919, women did have more freedom. After World War II, when women during the war were out in the workforce, independent, a lot of things conspired to kind of squash that. So post-World War II, women actually became the stereotypes we think of for the 1950s housewife.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because, you know, Vivian, even, you know, she's single and she's, you know, not the norm. You know, you get married, you have kids, and like her friend Lott did.
Yeah.
But she doesn't seem to care. Where
no.
Claire, on the other hand, is very concerned about fitting what the role she thinks she's supposed to play.
Absolutely. And I worked hard to give her enough background that you understood that she was raised to believe that if you did all the right things, you found happiness.
Mm-hmm.
But those right things had nothing to do with nurturing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
They were find the right husband who will take care of you and support you and make a nice house or home and raise your children well. And there is nothing wrong with any of that.
Mm-hmm.
But she is among the women who in that era began to question what they were taught.
Right.
And I liked, it was complete serendipity that 1961, when Claire's story takes place, is 2 years before Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique was published. And so when Claire tries to talk about it, even if the people or women around her have any of these feelings, even little rumblings, they're afraid to talk about it.
Of course,
it's not being talked about yet.
Yeah. All right. So we have Vivian and her close friend, Lottie, who have been friends since childhood. They're both orphans.
Yes.
And we have Lottie, who's very practical, and she's always telling Vivian, you know, you got to let David go. This is the lover who died in the earthquake, and move on. But Vivian just cannot do that.
Yes.
Tell us how she becomes the obituary writer.
It's actually by accident. It's one of those Alfred Hitchcock used to call them happy accidents when you don't script it, but it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a happy accident where a man, blinded by grief over the loss of his wife, stumbles into her apartment or her house to her front door, thinking it's the newspaper office and insisting that she write the obituary. And he can't stop talking about his wife. And although at first she's telling him, you're in the wrong place, his grief so speaks to her grief that she listens. And she writes it. And she marches it down to the newspaper office where they don't want to run it, but she says, you have to. We have to help this man. And so she kind of instinctively recognizes it's the healing power of listening.
Mm. Yeah.
And in a way, no one will listen to her
because
it's been over a decade. And as you said, her best friend and anyone else who would tell her saying to move on.
Right.
And so she finds how simple a thing for someone who feels like me to have someone listen.
And she doesn't write the normal obituary. The newspaper doesn't want to, they're going, wait a minute, there's no dates in here. It doesn't say when they're, and she said, no, this is, and her thing is she would ask them, tell me about it. So they get through all the, you know, facts and figures that she doesn't, she wants.
She doesn't even write them down.
Yeah, she doesn't even write them down. She wants to tell the story of the person.
Yeah, she brings the person to life one more time on the page. Yeah.
Right. Right. So it's, I don't think it's any giving anything away here that we've have both women have adulterous affairs.
Right.
And some readers have been critical of what they perceive to be a blasé portrayal of adultery. What do you think about that?
I didn't know that. I don't read any of the comments. Isn't that funny?
It's been happening for a long, long time.
Yeah. Have they read the Bible?
Yeah.
I don't think it's blasé, so I would have to disagree because Claire is tortured.
Yes, she is.
She is absolutely tortured by the affair she had, the effect it had on her husband, and his inability to forgive her. Although he will stay married to her, he can't forgive her, and he admits, rightly so, I don't know if I ever will.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not at all blasé in Claire's situation. It both transforms her and in a way ruins her.
Mm.
On the other hand, Vivian, who was a very young woman when she embarked on this affair, to me represents a lot of women, some of them not quite so young, single women who fall in love with married men and believe that they are going to have a future with them.
Right.
And so her heartbreak is kind of double because before he disappeared, he did not leave his wife.
That's right. All right. And so we have Vivian and Lottie. I don't want to give away what Lottie's grief is, but
right.
Lottie goes through a very traumatic time, and they both lose somebody. But react very differently.
Yes.
And I would imagine you're trying to say here that grief affects everyone differently.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yes. One of the wonderful things I stumbled upon in researching the earthquake, actually, was Emily Post's original book of etiquette.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was sitting on the table in my local library as I was reading about the 1906 earthquake and had gone down that rabbit hole, as you do in research, of suddenly I was reading about Chinese gambling dens in San Francisco in the late 1800s. I said, I need to take a break. I've gone too far. And picked up that book because someone had left it there. And the section on grief, I thought, was both brilliant and necessary. Yeah. And for Lottie and Vivian, the section I chose to sort of open that, the section from Emily Post, speaks about the role of friends in grief.
Yeah. Yeah, and so each chapter starts with one of these posts from Emily.
Yes.
Emily, her book of etiquette. All right, so you write, she understood that grief is not neat and orderly. It does not follow any rules. Time does not heal it. Rather, time insists on passing. And as it does, grief changes, but does not go away. Mm. And you write this, I noticed several times throughout the book, you keep talking about how grief changes,
yes,
but it never goes away.
Right. Well, I think it's a response to, you know, my daughter Grace died in 2002, so it's been 11 years. And sometimes when I'm in a wonderful mood or happy or doing something lovely, someone will say, I'm so glad you got over it. Mm. And they don't mean that to be insulting. And right. I know that. But I think, wow, what an innocent or foolish thought, because you don't get over it. You just live with it. I mean, we don't really have a choice.
Right.
And it changes. You know, there's the day you can finally look at pictures again, the day you can walk in her room. You know, all of that is the face of grief changing. Mm-hmm. And as years pass, it takes on different shapes. I mean, my husband found an old video of our son in the play Oliver. And we were laughing because Sam, who's now 6'5 and 20 years old, is this little blonde 8-year-old.
Yeah.
And then the camera pans, and we're both watching it to see Sam sing Food, Glorious Food, and the camera pans to Grace. And I had not seen her on a video.
Yeah.
And that could have put me to bed for weeks, not that long ago.
Yeah.
But I could sit and just marvel at her.
Yeah.
So that's an example of it changing.
Yeah. I want to go back to the knitting again.
Yes.
Because there are some men who knit as well.
Yes.
And it's interesting because it's usually you're in a women's circle, but and I think you in the knitting circle you had men there,
yes,
in that as well. Talk about, I mean, what do men say to you about knitting?
Well, you know, I have a lot of male friends who knit, and so I don't even think of it as all women. Although it is funny sometimes when you go into a store and you sit down to knit with a group of people and there's one man and he apologizes or something. But to me, it's perfectly natural. And I thought it was important to have males in it.
Yeah.
The three men, Andre Debuse III, John Dufresne, and a wonderful first novelist named Taylor Politis, who are in it, all have very different knitting stories. They're all different, really,
yeah,
the women
right.
too. But of the three, Taylor is the one who is an excellent and constant knitter. He really is a knitter. Andre knit one thing, and John tried to learn how to knit. So they have different stories, but I would say it reflects the women too, you know, who are different kinds of knitters.
The book is The Obituary Writer and also Knitting Yarns, Writers on Knitting and Hood. Always great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks, Mindy.
And you're going to be at Titcomb's Bookshop on November 19th, which is a Tuesday, 7 p.m., along with some of the other authors
yes.
In the book, including Anne LeClaire and Mary Ann Leone.
Yes, right. Yeah, right. Bring your knitting.
All right. Great. Good to see you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Coming up after a break, Anne Gagan, Hope Community Care's bereavement director, will join us to discuss the grieving process and how we can help friends and family who may be grieving.
I'm Marco Werman. American help is on the way to the Philippines, but it's not there yet. There's desperation and some looting.
As long as aid doesn't come, the situation is only going to get worse like that. And eventually, what little food there is here is going to run out.
Filipinos in the U.S. are waiting to hear from home.
The worst part is not knowing.
There's no communication.
We'll have the latest on the world. Tonight at 8 on WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station.
There's a lot of women that have this other kind of wild side. So we come up with different things that most social meetup groups do. We try to do things with a little edge to it. And we call ourselves the Sassy Seniors.
Jerry Moore of West Barnstable.
One of the first activities was that there was a woman who was 53 who had been married for 20-plus years and actually married her high school sweetheart. Reluctantly, she did admit that she often wondered what it would be like to sit at a bar by yourself. So we just all teamed together. We went shopping with her. We actually went to Forever 21 to get her a slinky red dress. She sat at the bar, ordered a Cosmopolitan. We had coached her on, you know, befriend your bartender. We were just back there laughing, and we'd just give her the okay signal.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NBR stations.
It just gave her a little boost, and she still has the red dress.
You're listening to The Point. This morning we're discussing the process of grief. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joining us in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Gagan, Hope Community Cares Bereavement Director. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
One of the things I loved in, as I mentioned in to Ann, with the Emily Post's little quotes that she used at the beginning of each chapter, and I know you read the book as well. Wasn't that brilliant?
It was so perfect and so simple. I think Emily Post was responding to the influenza epidemic in the early 1900s, the World War I, and all the grief that was occurring. And she gave individuals the opportunity to think, what can I do? That's a question that family and friends continue to have to this day, but it was practical and gentle and right on the mark.
Yeah. Yeah. And so funny, they've written so long ago.
It's, yes.
Yeah, some things never change, do they? So, Anne, oftentimes discussions about grief center around the five stages of grief, mm-hmm. denial and isolation, anger, bargaining, depression, and then acceptance. But not everyone experiences these stages, and grief is not necessarily a linear process.
Well, I think the thing that I've learned in listening to many, many people, grief is very messy. Mm. It's confusing, overwhelming. It affects every part of us. I think a lot of times people think grief, well, you cry, you're sad, you know, withdraw a little bit. But it's so profoundly disturbing to the entire human system. Socially, it affects everything socially. So people really find that they're lost oftentimes. And again, I think the book talks about this, and you've just mentioned it. It's something that each individual comes to differently, based on who they are and what their personality and the relationship with the individual whom they loved, their social context, whether they have support or don't have support. So all those things come into play in how a person deals with grief and the effects that they particularly feel.
Yeah. And you've obviously spent a lot of time with people going through the grieving process. And as we said, it's very individualized. But do you see trends in terms of how long it takes people to work through the intense grief? As we said, Anna's right, it never goes away. But, you know, that time of where it's so intense, again, it varies, I'm sure, from person to person. But generally, is there sort of a...
Well, I always, look at when did the person die? How did they die? What was the cause of death? Was it accidental? Was it the consequence of 10 years of deterioration through Alzheimer's dementia? Mm-hmm. So the family member who's left, the spouse or the child, their response and the length of the effects of grief are going to vary tremendously. Yeah. Certainly accidental death, the shock of that experience where 1 minute your loved one's there and the next minute or next hour they're gone, that reverberates physically for so long so that it takes quite a bit of time to just get through that initial period of physical shock.
Yeah.
Whereas what I've found, and I think this is really interesting and helps people understand, when it's been a long and long-term death, a gradual death, more often than not, the griever is feeling so exhausted afterwards and sometimes can't feel anything because they've been grieving.
Numb.
Yeah. Their loved one very gradually, as in Alzheimer's, if the patients lost their ability to get out of bed, and mm-hmm. and it goes on and on from there. So the grieving individual is going to end up oftentimes feeling a different kind of numb, a tired, exhausted numb versus a shock numb after an accidental death.
Yeah. It's interesting, as you're talking, I'm just thinking of my own parents, both of my parents. My mother died suddenly, and my father died after, you know, suffering from cancer for a while. So you knew it was coming. And so, you know, you got to really have conversations. And both of those processes, my mother's whole funeral is just sort of a blur because everything happened so fast, where there's a lot of memory with my father's death because it was a longer time period. Mm-hmm. Now, and the process was, you know, even though you love them both, the process is completely different.
Exactly.
You're saying, yeah.
Exactly. And I think the consequences to you, again, in remembering and experiencing what happened then are vastly different.
Exactly. Exactly right. We are talking with Ann Gagan, Hope Community Cares Bereavement Director. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And as you're saying, grief is not just an emotional process. It's a physical experience. So describe some of the physical manifestations of grief.
Well, again, everything that I'm going to talk to you about is what people have told me. I mean, I certainly read and stay on top of research, but it's in listening to the stories of individuals as they describe how they feel that I've come to understand this process a little bit more. Physically, some people, again, initially may be very agitated. In the book, the obituary writer, there's some mention of agitation, of walking around and aimlessness. You don't know what to do with yourself. You don't know where to put yourself. I think, again, I've watched with people that have had been with loved ones that went through cancer or Alzheimer's, there may even be a physical energy that comes up after the death, sort of an elation sometimes that is hard to describe and sometimes disturbing.
Yeah.
Well, there's a little physical relief that, again, folks have described after a death, that there's a relief that, well, I got through this with my parent. I was there for 2 years caring for them. Or the relief of the suffering of the person who I love so deeply is over. Mm-hmm. And then after that, physically, I often hear about the exhaustion. Mm-hmm. And this is really surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah.
They can't even move through a day.
It's all catching up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they can't decide anything, and they feel that it's too much effort to get dressed in the morning. Everything is an effort, and that surprises people a great deal. So physically, it's very much of a range. Once again, depending on who the person is, what the relationship was. Certainly, physically, the anguish. And how do you describe anguish? People say, I just want to, you know, people tear at their hair, like in the book. Or there's a physical need to express the inner anguish of loss.
Right. I've got an email here. It says, I can understand the host's grief. It was talking about Anne's grief of losing her daughter. My daughter also became suddenly sick from a virulent virus in 2005 when she was 4 years old. We were lucky that she survived after months in the hospital. Unfortunately, she was forever changed and now has various disabilities. My grief was so deep for many years, reminded every time I saw my daughter, this child in front of me was not who I knew in the past. Things got better. A therapist told me once that the picture I was painting for my life was filled with sadness, which affected my husband and my children, and it wasn't fair. Now I'm painting with new colors. The grief is still with me, but it doesn't dominate my life most days. Thanks for the program. I love to crochet, which does pass time and has a rhythm that keeps me in the present. So like the knitting, this is helping her. This speaks to that again. The grief doesn't go away. It just changes.
Exactly. And that's an incredibly beautiful story. Yeah. And I think that what I hear in that story is that the writer of the email had to go through everything she had to go through. And then there was a decision point. Mm-hmm. How am I going to paint the rest of my life? Right. What colors will I use? What hues do I right. use? And how do I look ahead? So it's taking control at a certain point of view. And there's almost a decision point somewhere along the line. But I don't think you can, I think you have to go through what the writer describes mm-hmm. before you can get to that decision point.
Yeah, exactly. Eric is giving us a call from Provincetown. Good morning, Eric.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I just thank you for this topic today. I just, my partner passed away from AIDS-related cancer back in 1991. And after sort of overcoming the initial sort of shock of watching your beloved pass away, what I found people didn't understand is that you grieve a variety of different things. It's not sort of just one sort of topic. I mean, I grieved the pain that I watched him suffer. Mm-hmm. I grieved the experience that I had, you know, watching him pass away. And I grieved the loss of the life that I was looking forward to having with him, you know, for the rest of our lives. And at any given moment, I may have been grieving one or more of those different components of that experience.
Yeah. And Anne's nodding her head as you're saying these things.
That's very well put. You grieve everything that that person was, and then you realize that they played so many roles in your life. They were your future. They were what you looked forward to. You're going to do this when, you know, you're going to hold hands and walk down the street when you're in your 80s. You construct your whole world around another person when you love them. And there are so many roles they play. I have something that I bring to the support groups I do, and it was written by a widow, and it's called When I Lost My Husband. And she goes into the myriad roles he played. I lost my caregiver. I lost my partner. I lost my confidant. I lost the person who would tell me I'm way off the mark. Mm-hmm. And Eric, I think that what you're describing is that totality of relationship. It's the person, but it's everything else that you bring into your life when you commit and love another person.
Yeah. Eric, thanks for sharing your story with us. Appreciate that. Yeah.
Thank you.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. And tell us about some of the programs that Hope Community Care has for those experiencing loss.
Well, we're fortunate at Hope Hospice, and this is a program of Hope Hospice, that we make a commitment first and to our hospice families, and part of the hospice benefit is bereavement care after death for the first 13 months following the death. Mm-hmm. So in that light, we have a commitment to our families that we want to take as good a care of you after the death of your loved one as we believe we do in the hospice process. So that is what we offer, and we offer individual counseling for as long as they need it. Many hospices meet that criteria by sending nice letters and phone calls, but we have a commitment. If a person needs to be seen weekly for 13 months, that's what they need. Mm-hmm. We also have hospice community care, which for folks that haven't been on our hospice care, they can come to us. We hope they understand that that's all we do. We're bereavement counselors, bereavement specialists, and using their insurance, they can receive one-on-one counseling. We also run support groups throughout the year. And again, we focus on groups that are time limited, 6 or 8 weeks, and focus on the particular type of loss. We don't put in people who have lost a child with people who have lost mm-hmm. a parent, because what we want to find that the people that come to the groups already have something in common, that they can find community. Because it's so often in groups, people look at each other, and even though their grief is 100% intimate and personal to them, they find that grief has universal characteristics. Mm-hmm, yeah. So it's not that aloneness. So we offer that. Then we have Hope Care for Kids, which is our children's program for children in the community who have lost a parent or grandparent or sibling, and that we're looking at starting our first. We hope to have our first camp for kids in the spring.
Let me ask about that. How do you talk to children about death? I imagine it depends on the age, of course, and the individual child. But that's always a tricky one. You know, let's say you're looking at a grandparent who's died, and you know you have a young child. Obviously, the grandparent played a role in their life. That's a tough call. And what do you tell them?
Well, again, through the work that we've done with children and families, we always start with the parents. Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, those little guys are looking at the parents
yeah.
or the remaining parent, or if it's one parent that died, they're going to look toward that parent. Mm-hmm. So we want to find out what is your family language?
Mm-hmm.
What have you said so far? What have you shared so far? How do you talk about death? Have you ever talked about death? So we really start with the parent, because that is who, when we walk out the door, the child will be talking to and looking at and following their lead.
Mm-hmm.
And then with children, always trying to understand and looking at the developmental
right.
level. And with children, it's usually always... they always have a point of reference,
mm-hmm.
whether it's the little bird that died or something that the goldfish that died or the dog that they loved, and nature, because mm-hmm. children are so tuned into nature. You can always find a connecting point with children.
And don't you have a dog that you use in your program?
We did in the past.
You did?
Yes,
okay.
yes.
Yeah.
We now, with the children's program, we've been using taking children and families to a farm in Plymouth,
oh.
the Black Feather Farm, that does, they're a rescue farm of horses and mules and donkeys. And it's not equine assisted therapy, but the children go in and we use empathy.
Mm.
The children see these sad mm-hmm. and injured animals, and they're told the stories of the animals, and the children oftentimes will relate and start talking about what's happened to them.
Mm, gotcha. Mm. We're talking with Ann Gagan, Hope Community Cares Bereavement Director. We're talking about the process of grief. If you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Now, you were mentioning that with some of these support groups, you separate, you know, the folks who may be losing a spouse, who have lost a child. Is there a difference in the grief when you lose a child versus a spouse?
Very different. In terms of the content of the stories, again, if it's a child, you're looking at, as a parent, of such a physical response, such a physical loss. It's indescribable. And also, you're looking at the loss of hopes, dreams, future, everything that any parent projects into their child. And often, because it's out of nature's way for a child to die, there's usually an accident or a terrible illness. It's not the normal course mm-hmm. in life. Whereas with spousal loss, even though it's tremendously painful and it can happen at any time, it's a very different kind of loss. And I don't those two groups together, because you don't want to compare losses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's and sometimes I've heard that if a person's lost perhaps a 98-year-old mother and she's sitting next to somebody who's lost a child, she will diminish or minimize mm-hmm. her own pain. That's not the
yeah.
purpose of the group. The group is to be able to get in touch with what you're feeling, mm-hmm. what this loss means to me, to the individual, and how they're going to reconstruct their lives afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But the spousal loss groups, again, are so profound, because those are people grieving someone they chose to love.
Right. And sometimes some of these people have been, when you've been married 50, 60, I mean, these people have been in your daily lives for almost all of
you
your
just
life.
Grow together.
Yeah, exactly.
You just...
So do you see differences in the way men and women deal with grief?
You know, there's a lot of work being done on that, and I think Ken Doka is a theorist that and a grief specialist who has really paid a lot of attention to that. And he talks more, rather than men and women, to a spectrum. Mm-hmm. And some women have, he talks about instrumental grievers that are people who have to do. Mm-hmm. And by and large, men tend to fall on that side of the spectrum. And women are much more, have a tendency to be more emotional, but it's a spectrum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the cutest things I remember in working with one gentleman, he was an engineer. I always ask about what their background is, so mm-hmm. I'll come to understand them. So he came in and he said, well, let's see, what do I need to do to get through this? What do I need to do? And he wanted instructions. And I, rather than say, well, that's not the way it's done, sir, I tried to put instructions in terms of the way he was thinking about grief. I gave him a little assignments because he clearly presented to me a need to have actions mm-hmm. right away.
Yep. So the process of dying and caring for the dead is very much a part of many cultures, but it's not a part of our culture. Do you think this impacts how we handle grief? Many cultures, you know, they're with the dead. They have rituals, and but we kind of seem to want to go, all right, we're going to move on.
It's amazing. Yeah. Right. And what we see is, I think we're in a culture of, where's the pill? Mm-hmm. Where's the pill to get over grief? Or where is the exercise routine I can do to get over grief? Or where can I go to get over grief? And all those fixes, remedies, they just don't work. So we're in a culture where if you're not really happy and up and together, there's very little place for you. I have so many people they step away from society, they step away from friends, they step away from family because they say, I'm just no fun to be with. Mm. I'm not great here at all. What are they going to talk to me? If I'm honest with them and they say, how are you doing? Do you want to know how I'm doing? Mm. How do you think I'm doing?
Right.
So they have to withdraw because we are in a society that likes to be up and wonderful and everything's okay and get over it. And if you just do this, this, and this, you'll be fine.
Yeah. And that might be too, you know, people are uncomfortable of approaching other people who, you know, I was telling you recently, I had a aunt who died and my uncle, I'm saying, so who are the other, they have no children. I'm like, who else is called? They're like, no one, even some of their friends haven't called, which surprised me. You know, so I thought, wow, and I'm sure a lot of it is they just don't know what to say.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's such a chasm of discomfort. And I think that the well-intended friend is a little fearful that you're going to really hear what it's really like. And we tend to be a little self-protective when we're not in that mm-hmm. place. But I try and help those folks that I see that are grieving to understand. I don't expect them to, it's not their job to make the other person feel comfortable. But I also try and help folks that ask this question. I say, just call. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't do, maybe avoid how are you doing and say, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And call again next week. Well, what are you doing now?
Yeah.
I had one gal that said it got her through the first year of grief. One friend called every week and she prefaced it by saying, you don't have to say anything. I'm just checking in and letting you know I'm thinking about you.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's amazing the conversations you will have that you didn't expect it.
Exactly.
You will have learned lots of things that you didn't already know. So tell us some of the do's and also some of the don'ts when interacting with those who are grieving.
Well, I think I just articulated one.
Listen.
listen takes time. And if you're going to ask someone, well, how are you doing? Make sure you've made time to respond, to sit and listen and hear them out if they wish to do that. If you're saying it just to be polite, don't say it.
Mm-hmm.
Because in groups, we usually end up having one session where people go around and say, you know what someone said to me? You know what someone said to me? Another big don't is that really offends people is when people say, I do know how you feel. And then they launch into their own story of Aunt Tilly, who died in, you know, 15 years ago. It's not about them at that time. Mm-hmm. But people, it's an effort to relate. And it's, again, it's not, you know, it's well-meaning. It's an effort to relate, but it so misses the mark.
Right.
It so misses the mark. And certainly imposing religious platitudes at a time where the griever may have be struggling very, very deeply with their faith. It often happens. That's mm-hmm. grief shakes us up on every level, including mm-hmm. the level of what our relationship is about God, whether we believe or don't believe, about the afterlife, whether we believe or don't believe. So the kindest thing one can do is start with a hug, if you're comfortable, and to say, you know, I don't know what to say, but I just want to know that I'm here. Mm. And as in the book, if you have time, tell me what you're thinking about John. And if you remember John's birthday, mm-hmm. send a birthday card or an anniversary when you know that that loved one had died. People right. are so moved by that.
Yeah. Well, you've got a lot of things going through my head right now because we are coming on the holidays.
Yes.
And you mentioned birthdays. Birthdays are tough, but so are those first holidays that you go through. I mean, they're all tough, but that first one especially. And as we're coming into that time of the year, how do you help people? And what do you tell them?
Well, people do seek help at this time because they know it. They're going to be so lost. And it varies with, I'm not going to do anything for the holidays. I'm going to go away. I have a number of people that I'm working or talking with now who are going to volunteer at a soup kitchen or to help other people serve turkeys, because holidays are about traditions. And holidays are about joy, and holidays are about families getting together. They're everything that has been shattered when you've lost a loved one. So how do you do that? How do you even approach it? How do you, some people soldier through, and they'll just go and do it the way they've always done it. But many people find the first year just, if I can just get through this, maybe I'll change my routines. Mm-hmm. I'll change my rituals. I was with a group last week and went around the room. And this is a group of folks, spouses who have all lost their loved one a year or more. And every one of them had a completely different ritual mm-hmm. than they traditionally had had. They right. always had the dinner at their house.
Right.
They always had the, you know, opening Christmas presents at their house. They always had the Hanukkah mm-hmm. Celebration at their house. And in every case, and there were nine women,
it
was different.
It. Yeah, we often have our own ideas as how long someone should grieve. And people will say she needs to move on or he should be over by now. But as we mentioned earlier, there isn't necessarily an end to grief. And people go through this process so differently. And I'm thinking of when Anne said, somebody said to her when she was having a good day, I'm so glad to see you got over it. Not that they're meaning to be mean, but there is this sort of expectation people have sometimes about, well, wow, it's been quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, you never really get over it.
No, you don't. And again, it comes from a place of wanting to see that person who the friend or family member cares about deeply. They love that person. They mm-hmm. care about that person. They don't want that person to be suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So it usually comes from a very good place, but it does set up a timeline.
Right.
And there's no timeline. And if a grieving person believes there's a timeline, well, I should be farther along than I am, then they always get disappointed.
Right.
Because they're comparing to something that doesn't exist.
And so, but there are some people who really struggle with the grief, prolonged grief, if you will. What are some of the signs of prolonged grief and how is that treated?
Well, certainly when you look at what appears like depression may be depression after a year. If a person is still unable to have any joy in their life, to have any looking forward, anything to anticipate, where perhaps they haven't addressed anything in their environment, where they've kept the environment exactly the same. Some people have to do that for a while. But if it's a cluster, and most prominently, if they can't find any joy in simple activities, maybe their grandchild coming over, after about a year or two, then it sounds like it would be depression.
Some help. Sometimes people are afraid to bring up the loss or talk about the person that's died with someone who is grieving. But in many instances, that's exactly what helps the most. As you know, Sean Corcoran, our reporter here, produces our Life Remembered series. And he says universally when he calls to talk to the families of the deceased, they want to talk about their loved ones.
That's all they want to do. Yeah.
Honor their memory.
And bring them into the present.
Right.
Because that's one of the things that is... I think one of the most healing aspects of grief, once you get through the very, very dark and difficult parts, is bringing the loved one into the present. Meaning, you know, when you go for a drive, a lot of my beautiful spouses that have been with their loved one, we'll talk to them. Well, we're going to go to the store now, Marge. And it's not crazy. It's bringing them into the present. Mm-hmm. Because your loved ones always live within you. The Native Americans, the more of the traditional cultures say they live within you, and it is true. Mm-hmm. So to talk about them brings people such joy.
Right.
That's another thing people can do, and not be afraid.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, as our obituary writer in Ann Hood's book, she told the story of the person's life, not all those little, you know, factual information, but who they were as a person. Yeah. And so, Ann, we're going to put up a link on our website to yours for folks who might want more information about the services that you have. And Gagan is Hope Community Care Bereavement Director. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
It was my pleasure.
And thanks for our caller and our emailer for sharing their stories with us as well. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.